This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com. Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, January 13th, 2013. After last week's sort of, I don't want to say hiatus, but we backtracked a bit to go to the rabbinic world again to discuss some things about Hora'at Sha'ah. And I wanted to, you know, go from there. I apologize for not doing it in the rabbinic period, but we're going to go back to Rambam. And I decided that, you know, the introduction to the Mishnah Torah is wonderful, but he fleshes out a lot more detail with not just how halacha works, but in particularly rabbinic authority. So I want to start today with two things. One is a brief introduction where he talks about the legitimacy of rabbinic commandments more explicitly, also kind of in the introduction to Mishnah Torah, but in the later part. And then we're going to move on to Hilchot Mamrim, the laws of rebels. I mean, I was thinking of doing perhaps Hilchot Sanhedrin, but that gets into a little more of the nitty-gritty of, you know, getting who qualifies as a judge, and there's certain things about acceptance, and I think it would take us a little bit too far off topic, although if people here want, we can do Hilchot Sanhedrin too. But in Hilchot Mamrim, it's, you know, Mumar is a rebel. So he'll discuss, in a sense, how halacha works by way of who's not keeping it. All right? So from Hilchot Mamrim, we get a lot more about Rambam's view more explicitly on not just the halachic process, but the violations thereof. And again, if people afterwards want to go to Hilchot Sanhedrin, I have absolutely no objection. Danach, do you take the first part? So this is a section called Mitzvot Derabbanan, part of the Haktamah, part of the Rambam's introduction, at least in that section. I forget exactly where it falls out in relation. If you pick up like a typical Rambam of Mishnah Torah, you'll have like the Hakdamah Mishnah Torah. He'll also have the 613 commandments. He'll also have a breakdown of the entire Mishnah Torah and like what halachot go under, you know, what section and all that. And somewhere among there, he has a very short essay on the rabbinic commandments. So start us off, Dana.
These 613 mitzvot were given to Moses on Mount Sinai together with their general principles, particular points and details. These general principles, particular points and details represent the oral law which each court received from the previous court.
All right, and that we saw from the larger introduction, where he went through the entire chain of tradition from God giving the Torah to Har Sinai to Ravashi, and then made a point of doing it in reverse order to hammer the point home that it's all point of one tradition. All right?
There are also other commandments that were instituted after the giving of the Torah. They were established by the prophets and the sages and spread throughout Israel. For example, the reading of the Megillah, lighting a Hanukkah candle, fasting on Tisha B'Av, setting up Erevin, and washing one's hands in preparation for prayer and eating. Each of these commandments also possesses explanatory aspects and details. All of this will be explained in this text.
All right, so this comes up with some of your questions, Dan, about like where do the sages come up with making new things? Right, Tisha B'Av's a new thing that the rabbis set up, right? And we saw this in the Gemara about Hanukkah candles. How do you say Asher Kedishana B'Mitzvotav Etzivanu, right? How do you have a blessing for God giving you a commandment for something where there is no commandment, right? Or at least no biblical commandment, I should say. Go ahead.
We are obligated to accept and observe all these commandments which the rabbis instituted as implied by Deuteronomy 17:11. Do not deviate from the instructions that they will give you, left or right.
So according to Rambam here, the basis for rabbinic authority is biblical. Like, what gives rabbis the right to make up new laws? Well, the Torah says, you should not deviate from the instructions they give you, left or right. And this is, in fact, the verse that we saw the Gemara in Shabbat uses to validate why you say, Asher Kedishana B'Mitzvotav Etzivanu, on lighting Hanukkah candles. All right, Sharon, take the next paragraph.
They are not considered to be additions to the commandments of the Torah. If so, what was the intention of the Torah's warning, Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 11, do not add to it and do not detract from it, that a prophet is not permitted to introduce a new measure and say that the Holy One, blessed be He, commanded this mitzvah to us and that it should be added to the Torah's mitzvot, or say that He commanded that we eliminate one of the 613 mitzvot mentioned above. However, if a court, together with the prophet of that age, adds a commandment as an ordinance, a lesson, or as a decree, this is not considered as an addition. He is not saying that the Holy One, blessed be He, commanded us to make an Eruv or read the Megillah at its appointed time. Were he to say so, he would be adding to the Torah. Instead, we are saying that the prophets and the courts ordained and commanded that the Megillah be read at its appointed time in order to recall the praise of the Holy One, blessed be He, the salvation he wrought for us and His response to our cries, so that we will bless Him, extol Him, and inform the future generations of the truth of the Torah's promise, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 7. What nation is so great that it has God close to it?
And then just the last line, that similar principles apply with regard to all other rabbinic commandments, be they positive commandments or negative commandments. So for Rambam here, it seems almost semantic. There's a very big difference, not just in at the end of the day, you still might have to do something, but it's how do you portray this nature of obligation? According to Rambam, the main prohibition about adding or detracting from the Torah, well, first he attributes it specifically to a prophet, where he says, Shelo yehei navi, that a prophet cannot use his position of having a direct communication with God to say, hey, God gave us a new mitzvah, or I've got a brand new thing that you never heard of before that God told me that you all now have to do. Right, which is very different than rabbis getting together and saying, we, by virtue, by the power vested in us by the Torah itself, are coming up with a new decree. In other words, when Chazal make a decree, there's a very big difference between, well, let's make the following distinction. The Rambam's going to discuss this in Mamrim as well. One is interpretive, where you're not saying that, God is in, we have a new commandment from God, but rather you're reading this document of the Torah in a certain way that this is what the law ought to be. Then you have things that are completely new, right? Like Hanukkah candles, reading the Megillah. Chazal never said, God told us to do this. They did not rely on their authority directly that God told us to do something specific. What they would say is, we are operating under this divine authority, and based on that divine authority, the body of us have decided to do something. So it's a matter of being honest as to the origins of whence is the law coming.
You have to rewrite the bracha. Bracha said God commanded us.
Well, according to the Gemara, the reason why it's Asher Kedisham Tavit Sivanu, the commandment for us was to listen to the sages. Or at least that's what the Gemara said. And that is, again, the basis for why they did what they, the basis for how they can get away with making new rituals, right? Because God said, you have to listen to these sages there. But what they do not have the right to do is to say, well, look at it this way. The Torah was given, following the biblical narrative in a very public revelation, right? No secret laws. We're told at the very end, Lo b'shamayim hi, right? It's not in heaven that we're supposed to go up and, that we should ask someone to go up and get it for us. Once the Torah is given, there's a certain democratic element in the sense of equal access to the law. Argument I had years ago with someone was about open source Judaism. Right? In a sense, it kind of is open source in that everyone has equal access to it. Once you have a prophet that says, I can speak to God, well, of course you can't speak to God, and here's what God told me you ought to be doing, then it's no longer a public revelation. At least within the legislative process, you know where everything is coming. What was divinely revealed, say in the Torah, was given in public and passed down. What?
About those 40 days on the mountain.
Yeah, and the Torah was disseminated then to the rest of the Jewish people.
Moses said, this is what God told me.
All right. Well, fair point. Although you could, probably anticipate that if God had any issues at the time, God would have spoken up. And God did quite often, because we did do a fair amount of testing there. But yes, the point is, let's say I would come up in shul and say, God told me, need to come up with a crazy thing. Everyone has a mitzvah. God told me everyone has a mitzvah to drink tea every morning. Right? No, it's not an offensive type of thing. I mean, tea's really good for you. Right? Could even be decaf. I don't care. But the point is, you're now changing the entire power dynamic of Judaism.
It can't be number 614.
Exactly. It can't be. That is a great way of putting it. By the same token, Rabbi, no one has, a prophet can say, oh, God just spoke to me, and now I am permanently uprooting an existing law. Right? To say, oh, remember 6:8? We're down to 6:12. Although the truth is, there's a machloket in the Gemara about how many mitzvot there are. We haven't relied on 6:13, but whatever. The point is, you know, you can't come up and say permanently there is no mitzvah. We spoke about last week about hora'at sha'ah, about, you know, in exigent circumstances, spending, you know, a law for a temporary purpose, right? Like Eliyahu at Har Carmel, but that's not, you know, the same as saying, oh yeah, now everything is okay, right? And I think one of the reasons why Rambam specifically mentions here Navi is that when you go through a prophet, it's an oracular form of religion. What Chacham Yosef Or would call more of a vertical religion, a top-down.
Oracular,
you go to an oracle.
Oh.
Meaning it's a top-down where one person has access to the divine and no one else does. At least with the Sanhedrin, the things are, you know, debated and discussed in public or passed and ratified and all that sort of thing, which, you know, we'll get to in greater detail. Now, you might not necessarily like what they do, and we'll discuss it, but it's not the same as saying, oh, these people have a secret access to God. They are privy to a certain relationship with God, which no one else does. Right, that is antithetical to the halachic system, at least according to Rambam.
Also, don't we have to ask a Navi to prove himself?
Yeah, but when you consider, according to the Torah, how do you know if a Navi is a true Navi? If he tells you something's going to happen and he does it. All you need to do, though, is a little bit of magic tricks, and, you know, you could fool a lot of people. And what was that line? As advanced science is indistinguishable from magic. I'm blanking on who said that. Is it Heinlein? I'd like to say Heinlein.
There's also the Vayasu Chena Chartumim Bilateyam.
So how are you supposed to know? See, that's the weird thing. Or what if I say, you know what, the world's going to end in 50 years, right? Well, we don't know if you're a true prophet, so guess we're going to have to wait and see. Right, you can always like set it so far in the future, and then you've got outs. You know, things like, oh, I mean, there's, if anyone wants, we could do separately. Rambam in Yesodei HaTorah, I think chapters 6 and 7 discuss the laws of a prophet and like when did this stuff have to come true or not come true. But you know, you can go. I mean, you can have someone like Mind Freak Chris Angel. That's it, right? He does some pretty amazing stuff. Heck, Penn and Teller, right? You like bring them back, you know, a few thousand years, and they'd either be considered prophets or burnt at the stake, right? Because, well, they could say, hey, you know, we're going to do this, right? And then poof, it happens. So, you know, just because someone, you know, puts on a sign, you know, but even so, according to Rambam, let's say there, it's a legitimate Navi, right? There's a difference, even if he would prove himself as legitimate, there would be a difference to say, you know, I'm getting rid of a mitzvah, or I'm coming up with brand new ones, versus, you know what, we're going to do this in an actual Beit Din, right, or through an act of legislation. Meaning a Navi, you know, if he's the head of a court, you know, and Rambam had in his list had a bunch of prophets who were, right, then go through the judicial process. But going through, in which case the Navi has every right to do, but then it's a force of rabbinic law, not of through the force of specific private divine revelation. And that's the core part here, right? So here Rambam, you know, explains, you know, again, very briefly the authority of the rabbis and why they're allowed to make up new things, even though there is a prohibition against adding to the Torah. And the reason is you can't come up with a new mitzvah and say, oh, yes, this is specifically what God wanted you to do. And Chazal are very careful to distinguish between what's the Oraita and what's the Rabbanan. And it's not just, I think, for punitive measures, but also for educational purposes about how the law is supposed to be structured. At what point are they actually, you know, elaborating and discussing, you know, here's what the text of the Torah means, and in which case, you know, interpretations could be considered biblical, right? Like an eye for an eye, right? Even though we don't actually pluck out someone's eye, the biblical, you know, law would be you would take money from it because that's how the sages defined it. Is very different than saying we're coming up with a brand new rule, right? Okay, excellent. So let's go to the second handout here. I just copied here just chapter 1 of Hilchot Mamrim. Again, the laws of rebels in Rambam. Then you start us off with Halacha 1 in chapter 1.
The Supreme Sanhedrin in Jerusalem are the essence of the oral law. They are the pillars of instruction from whom statutes and judgments issue forth for the entire Jewish people. Concerning them, the Torah promises in Deuteronomy 17:11, "You shall do according to the laws which they shall instruct you." This is a positive commandment. Whoever believes in Moses and in his Torah is obligated to make all of his religious acts dependent on this court and to rely on them.
Right, so this is a pretty emphatic statement, very much in line with what we saw in the introduction and in the separate piece over here, that the Sanhedrin, right, it calls the Ikar Torah Sheba'al Peh. That is the institution. They are the ones that the laws, it says Chok Mitzvot Yotzei L'chol Yisrael. Their decisions are binding on all Jews. As you may remember from his introduction from a couple of weeks ago, this would be in stark distinction to other courts who do not have the same universal authority. Right, what Sanhedrin says, you have to do because of their authority. What a later court might say, or one that does not have, let's say a court that might have appeared in Baghdad in the year 900, would not have that same universally binding halachic authority. And he says again that the basis is from that same verse in the Torah. It says, "Al piyat Torah she yorucha," that you have a positive commandment to do what this court says, again relying on the divine authority assumption. And he continues, any person who does not carry out their directives transgresses a negative commandment. As it continues, do not deviate from any of the statements they relate to you, neither to the right nor to the left. Which means, practically, according to Rambam, if the Sanhedrin HaGadol makes a decree, you don't listen to it, in addition to whatever violating a rabbinic law, you're violating a positive rabbinic commandment and a negative rabbinic commandment at the same time. If anyone's interested, I did a very large paper for Dr. Elman and Revel on violating multiple biblical prohibitions with one action. It's very dry and technical, so I'm not going to force that on you. Yeah.
So rather than disobeying, are you allowed to challenge the rabbi?
We're not there. We're getting there. We're getting there. This is just, remember, chapter 1-1. So I think I should just add in as a digression, slight digression here. Rambam often writes from the general to the specific. So sometimes people will say, like, he's contradicting himself one for the next. Like, no, he begins very general, and then he elaborates and gives you a lot of details as he goes on through the halacha. So we're going to get there. He continues here, lashes are not given for the violation of this prohibition because it also serves as a warning for a transgression punishable by execution by the court. For when a sage rebels against the word of a court, he should be executed by strangulation. As it is, as the following verse says, a person who shall act deliberately. We are obligated to heed their words, whether they, A, learn them from the oral tradition, i.e. the oral law, B, derive them on the basis of their own knowledge through one of the attributes of biblical exegesis, and it appeared to them that this is the correct interpretation of the matter, or C, instituted the matter as a safeguard for the Torah, as was necessary at a specific time. These are the decrees, edicts, and customs instituted by the sages. It is a positive commandment to heed the court with regard to each of these three matters. A person who transgresses any of these types of directives transgresses a negative commandment. This is derived from the continuation of the above verse in the following manner. According to the laws which they shall instruct you, this refers to the edicts, decrees, and customs, which they instruct people at large to observe and strengthen the faith and perfect the world. According to the judgment which they relate, this refers to the matters which they derive through logical analysis, employing one of the methods of biblical exegesis. And finally, from all the things that they tell you, this refers to the tradition that they received from one another. So Rambam even breaks the verse down into its three components, to the three elements, I suppose, of Jewish law that you're going to find from the sages. One are things that you derive from, say, an oral tradition of like how things were supposed to be done. Another are things that the Beit Din themselves decide to take on their own through interpretation. And finally, are the matters that they decide on their own that have no precedent in a way. Interestingly, I should point out here, Rambam uses the term gezerot takanot v'minhagot, right? Laws, decrees, and customs. And you may recall from our class on customs, right? According to Rambam, at least, in order for a custom to be a legitimate custom, it has to actually be legislated. It's not just random things that people happen to do, right? So, okay. So here we have Rambam list. Yeah.
Does that mean there are no minhagim after the Sanhedrin?
But it's not a matter of minhagim as much as legally binding minhagim, or at least they're separate rules of custom. If you're talking about a custom that was legislated by the Sanhedrin, like here's how you do a certain thing, then that would be applicable, you know, to all Jewish people. But once you have, if you're talking about local minhagim, as long as that custom doesn't violate extant Jewish law, you would have to do it as long as you're there. But say, the Jewish community in New York doesn't have to keep the same minhag as a Jewish community in Kansas. Mm-hmm. Right? That would be the difference. So there are rules of minhagim, but he's talking here about the laws that are universally obligatory across all Jews in all times, unless something is overturned. Dana, halacha number 3.
There can never be any difference of opinion with regard to matters received through the oral tradition. Whenever a difference of opinion arises with regard to any matter that shows that it was not received in the tradition from Moses, our teacher. The following principles apply with regard to matters derived through logical analysis. If the entire body of the Supreme Sanhedrin agrees with regard to them, their consent is binding. If there's a difference of opinion, we follow the majority and decide the matter according to the majority. Similarly, with regard to the decrees, edicts, and customs, if a portion of the judges perceived that it was necessary to issue a decree, institute an edict, or establish a custom for the people, and a portion perceived that it is not appropriate to issue this decree, institute this edict, or establish this custom, the judges should debate the matter back and forth, and afterwards a vote is called, and we follow the majority and execute the matter according to the decision of the majority.
Right. So hold on. So there are actually two distinct statements here. The first one is almost tautological, where he says that the things that are considered divrei kabbalah, things that were inherited through the oral tradition, ein behen machloket la'olam, have never been disputed. And if there happens to be one, then biyadua she'eino kabbalah mimoshe rabbeinu, then you know that it wasn't actually received. Right? And it's a fascinating new statement to make here, because we saw in one of the earlier classes that there could be errors in the chain of tradition. People can make mistakes. But Rambam's saying almost tautologically that whatever is from Moshe, no doubt about it. And if there's a doubt, then you know it's not part of the oral tradition straight from Moshe. Now, does that mean that there isn't any machloket? Of course not. You can have plenty of machloket over a whole lot of things still following certain models. So, for example, the midot, the halachic means of exegesis, right? Those you can say are part of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. But how they're applied could very well be a matter of dispute. My own recent doing Daf Yomi found a whole bunch of exceptions regarding Gzera Shava, of the connecting two laws by means of a textual analogy. So we taught yesterday a Gemara from Shabbat about that connected the Benot Slavchad, the Benot Slavchad were women in the desert whose father died. They didn't have any brothers, were concerned about their inheritance. There's another narrative that talks about a Mikoshesh Eitzim, someone who gathered sticks, and Moshe didn't know what to do with them. So according to Rabbi Akiva in the Gemara, since in one case, by the Mikoshesh Eitzim, the gatherer of sticks, he's mentioned as having done it Bamidbar, in the wilderness, and the Benot Slavchad say that their father died in the wilderness, therefore he says that Slavchad was in fact the Mikoshesh Eitzim, that it was the same person. And there seems to be a dispute there, and also whether, yeah. Now, there's some Gemaras that seem to indicate that Gzera Shava, that type of exegesis, has to be inherited from a tradition. And I suggested once that it's because if people are left to make their own textual connections, you have Ein LaDavar Sof. Like, Bamidbar appears a whole lot of times, right? You can make pretty much any connection there. Right, so having that certain traditions, in a way, like limits it, but there are Gemaras that seem, reading it at face value, seem to indicate that, you know, some can actually actively learn it out, whereas others can't. One second. Right. So you could say, though, like even between that you can have a tradition, you can all agree that there's a certain mode of exegesis that everyone is using, but you could also apply it differently regarding to a text. And you've got a whole lot of machloket, even in Midrash Halacha, about how to read a text halachically. Lo tefashel gidi b'chalev imo. Don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. I'm blanking on how many. The Gemara has three, but the Midrash Halacha has something like six different ways of reading. Why does it appear in the Torah three times? Whole lot of different reasons behind it. Right? Now, they're all doing the same thing, which is, well, we have a seemingly redundant verse, but they'll apply it differently. Right? So you can say that the underlying method might be Kabbalah from Moshe, because they're all agreeing on the how, but how they're applying it might not be, because they're disagreeing on the specifics. Yeah.
I can wait.
Okay.
The Sanhedrin is empowered to, I'm sorry to use such a generic phrase, but the Sanhedrin is empowered to make new law.
Yeah. Right?
So that being the case, why do we say that everything has to be inherited from a tradition when the Sanhedrin is empowered to make new law?
Who is we? When you say we say, who is we?
Well, in this case, the Rambam. Why does the Rambam...
Because there's a certain thing called Divrei Kabbalah. There's a difference between saying he made three distinctions, right, in the previous halacha, right, of, you know, things gotten directly from Moshe.
Yes.
You've got things that they, you know, used to come up with on their own in terms of biblical readings. And you've got a third category of new decrees that they make themselves. Now, you can ask, you know, well, what's the real difference between them practically if you still have to do all of it? And I think that's a fair point. But, you know, there's a huge difference. He's acknowledging that they have a right to come up with new things, but packaging also kind of does matter, right? It's part of the oral, well, it's not part of the oral. He'd say it's part of the oral and written tradition that the sages have a right to come up with new stuff.
Yeah.
But you have to know under what category the things come under so that you at least know what you're dealing with. And he's going to make some distinctions later on. All right. Yeah.
The first category of those three is Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, right?
Mm. Yes, that's one way of putting it.
Is that considered to Oraita? Is category one to Oraita?
No, it's considered part of Torah Shebaal Peh, as far as I know. It's
and
a weird situation.
That doesn't have a thrust of Oraita.
Doesn't seem to, although it could be... That's not a fair way of putting it. So, like, one of the examples given in the footnotes here of the Eliyahu Tuber translated Rambam about, you know, what are the things inherited from Har Sinai includes things like, what are the exact species for the Arba Minim, right, for the Lulav? Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it's hard to say whether or not that's not biblical or not. Because, yes, there's an oral tradition. You've got, like, statements about, you know, here's what you're supposed to do, but how do you know exactly what genus and species you're supposed to be taking, or four of them, right? So there you've got an oral tradition that directly impacts biblical law. So I'm not sure if that real distinction really plays.
But, I mean, you've emphasized that we're very careful to maintain the distinction between Doraita and Darabana.
Right. So here at least they can say that there's, you know, where's the thing here? I'll read the footnote, number 15. Note the Rambam's introduction to commentary in Mishnah, which elaborates on the subject, explaining that there was never any difference of opinion. Among the Jewish people about which species to use on Sukkot, although description of some of the four species in the Torah do not give clear indications as to which species I'll guess to use. The Jewish people have always employed the same four. Similarly, in all courts throughout people's history, an eye for an eye, there we go again, Exodus 21:24, has always been interpreted as referring to financial payment, not actually gouging a person's eye out. These and similar matters have always been universally accepted. So, according to this, Rambam would say, well, this would be an example of something that was, in fact, part of the core oral tradition, because there has never been any debate over those. All right? So that's part one of Halacha 3. Part two is, effectively, majority rule, right? Which is, the Sanhedrin should debate, and ultimately, you vote on it, right? And the important thing is that it's supposed to be a public well, it's supposed to be at least debated here. It says, Nosi'im v'notinim elu k'neged elu. You're supposed to engage in an actual, you know, dialogue. One would hope that it would be a lot more respectful than we have today. But, you know, but before you decide to actually do something, you should, in fact, hammer it out, right? And go through, like, for what's ever going on behind it, which we really don't seem to have anymore. Like even today in Congress, like people will make speeches on the Senate floor and the House of Representatives. But my understanding is people kind of make up their own minds before they actually vote, and it's just more of to get something in the congressional record and send something back home to your constituents. But it's not like, you know, hey, here's a bill, let's sit and discuss it. There's
psychologists can make that claim about every single decision we make.
Yeah, could be. Yeah,
but presumably the one would hope they are working this out in committee before they get to the floor.
Maybe. different procedures of election, and maybe not as complicated. Mm-hmm. Where are you up to, Sharon? Could you read number four?
When the Supreme Sanhedrin was in session, there was never any prolonged differences of opinion among the Jewish people. Instead, if a doubt arose in a Jew's mind over any law, he would inquire of the court in his city. If not, the questioner in that court, or its agents, ascend to Jerusalem and ask the court which holds sessions on the Temple Mount. If they know, they will reply to him. If they do not know, everyone comes to the court that holds sessions at the entrance of the Temple courtyard. If they know, will reply to him. If they do not know, everyone comes to the chamber of hewn stone, to the Supreme Sanhedrin, and presents the question. If the matter that was unresolved by all the others was known to the Supreme Sanhedrin, either as part of the oral tradition or because of its derivation through the principles of exegesis, they relate the decision immediately. If, however, the decision was unclear to the Supreme Sanhedrin, they deliberate about the matter at that time and debate it back and forth until they reach a uniform decision or until a vote is taken. In such a situation, they follow the majority and then tell all the questioners, this is the halacha. The questioners then all depart.
See, isn't this a great system? Right? You ask people, right? You get an answer, and he'll elaborate a little bit more about this more in the Laws of Sanhedrin, where he goes through the whole like court appellate system. The Jewish court, as we said a bunch of times, is a combination of judicial and legislative simultaneously, right? So here, it's like, yeah, you work your way up to the Supreme Court, they debate it back and forth, this is the law, great, problem solved, right? This is what they said. All right, pretty simple, but what's the problem? Continue.
After the Supreme Sanhedrin was nullified, differences of opinion multiplied among the Jewish people. One would rule an article is impure and support his ruling with a rationale, and another would rule that it was pure and support his ruling with a rationale. This one would rule an article is forbidden, and this would rule that it is permitted.
So you see, one of the great things about the Sanhedrin was you had one unified source that you went to for answers. Additionally, it wasn't one individual person, right? There was some accountability. You had a lot of people that were arguing back and forth over stuff, and ultimately they came up with a decision and you knew what should be, right? After that, no one has that power anymore to say, here's what you're supposed to be doing. Then, that's kind of where we are today, at least according to Rambam. Dan, take the final one here, number five.
The following rules apply when there are two sages or two courts that have differing opinions in an age when there was no Supreme Sanhedrin, or during the time when the Supreme Sanhedrin was still undecided concerning the matter, whether in one age or in two different ages. One rules that an article is pure and one rules that it is impure. One forbids an article's use and one permits it. If one does not know in which direction the law tends, should the matter involve a question of scriptural law, follow the more severe opinion. If it involve a question of rabbinic law, follow the more lenient opinion.
Right, so this is more of a general guideline. It says, "Im einecha yode leheichan hadin noteh." If you do not know what the law is, right, then this is safek derabanan lekula, and safek deoraita lechumra. If it's a doubt regarding a biblical law, you act stringently until the court tells you. Right? This seems to be the implication here. Right? Until you know for certain what the law is, or two people are telling you different things and you don't know what to make of it, if it's a biblical law, you follow strict. If it's a rabbinic law, you go lenient. And we discussed this halacha in the Laws of Stringency. And I heard Rabbi Saul Berman once said that the ones who are knee-jerk, reactionary, stringent, even on rabbinic laws, are in fact antinomian. that you're supposed to be lenient here. And according to Rambam, the leniency comes up, or at least his type of suffik is, when you don't know any better. Right? This is when there's a machloket, when something is still undecided, what do you do in the meantime? Implication being, if it comes out from the actual decision that a biblical law is ruled leniently and a rabbinic law is ruled stringently, then once that ruling is issued, that's what you do. Or once you know with some degree of certainty is what you're supposed to do, this is what you're supposed to do. But it's more of a, as I read it, it's more of a liminal stage of here's practical advice until you know better. There's a story that tell from Rav Tendler, who said that people who say instinctively that you need something l'chumra, like we don't know what the halacha is, it's got to be strict. He said that that's not exactly a psak as much as the avoidance of a psak. Because if you don't know what the halacha is, and you're in fact a posek, I mean, it's one thing of like, random person doesn't know what the halacha is, okay, you know what you're supposed to do. But if you're in a position where someone is asking you to give a psak halacha, and I say you're in that position, meaning you're a rabbi in some official position of authority, and someone's asking you to give a halachic, you know, answer, then if you don't know what the answer is, you don't say, do this misafik, but if you don't know what the halacha is, you research and you do work until you get the halacha, until you actually figure it out. And if you can't, well then, don't answer it. But to say that, oh, you should do it misafik isn't, you know, that's more of an avoidance thing. It's more like, I don't know what to do, so you should be strict. The ideal answer is, you find out what you're supposed to do. And if you can't do it, then direct the person to someone who can. So, and that actually came up with one of the more, you know, questions, but still to date, the weirdest question I got, where I asked, I'm not going to go into the details in case anyone's listening, where I asked one prominent rabbi, well, I shouldn't say, I don't know how prominent someone is, one fairly well-known rabbi, a certain law, and he said, you know, it needs, you know, need to be stringent because, you know, we could see it either way. Following Rav Tendler, I had already assumed not, you know, I wasn't going to listen to him. And he did, though, say that I should ask someone else. So to give him some degree of credit, I asked, can I ask this person? He said, that would be wonderful. I called that other person, and within 5 minutes, he gave me a dispensation that was absolutely brilliant because he just, like, hit the nail on the head. So, yeah, that does come up every now and again. You had some questions?
When there's a disagreement,
mm-hmm.
and you say, well, if you're not sure, then be stringent.
Mm-hmm.
Each party in the disagreement is sure.
Well, yes and no. Like, two people can have different opinions, but how are you supposed to be machria? How are you supposed to pick which one to follow? Like, let's say today, and the truth is Rambam, you know, will spend some more time with this. In the introduction, he says, you follow Misha da'at nota. You follow whomever convinces you, right? But sometimes, like, in order to do that, you have to, like, go into the nitty-gritty details about who's saying what and why, and does it really make sense, and what's the criteria by which you make sense. Just to give, like, two examples of well-known, you know, halakhic decisors, I've got Rav Moshe Feinstein on one hand, Rav Avadya Yosef on another. Now, I'm not in any position to give either one bechinot, and to say who's smarter than the other, right? I think we can both stipulate, both individuals were incredibly knowledgeable about Torah and Halakha, right? Don't think anyone's going to say otherwise. Both of them, very well respected, a lot of followers. Okay. So let's say I have a Halakha question. One says one thing, one says the other. What am I supposed to do? Now, unless I actually, like, go into the details and figure out, well, why is he saying this and why is he saying that, you know, I got to find some way of, you know, knowing how to act, because, you know, if you're just going to be strict, like, you don't want to be strict according to every possible source. We saw that in the Gemara on stringency.
Are you looking for a cipher?
No. Sorry about the thing on stringency, that if you always follow the stringent opinions, you follow the Chumrot of Hillel and the Chumrot of Shammai, you're considered an idiot, right? So on one hand, it's safer in some senses, but it's also a lot more dangerous, especially if it's a matter of policy. I also think that there's a difference between what an individual does personally and what is dictated to other people to do. And I've, you know, this is an approach, a distinction that I've made in my own life too. Like, you know, say in this shul, like, I know not everyone is that observant. And there's, you know, kind of, I want to say, I guess kind of a live and let live mentality. I teach halacha, I know not everyone is going to do whatever they want, fine. But there's a very big difference between a choice that someone makes to either do halacha or to do certain practices or not do certain practices, and then telling other people, here's what you ought to do. Right? So let's say I've got a machloket between, you know, Rav Moshe and Rav Avad Yosef. And I'm like, you know what? I can't tell the two apart. I'm going to act stringently in this case. Right? Even if it's on a rabbinic matter. All right, so the Gemara is not, if you do that on a regular basis, Gemara is not too thrilled with that, but all things considered, you know, being, you know, considered a fool as opposed to a Rasha, if you always go to the lenient side, you know, fine. But there's a very big difference, I would say, between me making a personal decision to choose stringencies and me telling other people, hey, you ought to follow stringencies. Or me getting up in a shul and saying, hey, you know what, you should always be choshesh, you should always suspect for every scenario. And there are people who do that, maybe not explicitly in those words, but that's certainly the message they convey. That, I think, is a much, much bigger problem. Because if a personal chumra versus dictating other people that the ideal halacha is to be as strict as possible and to worry about every possible scenario, because that's just flat out wrong. All right, so that would be a distinction that I would make there.
If you're worried about losing your share in Olam Haba,
yes and no, because how is that playing safe? When Chazal say Safek Derabanan LaHakel. And you say, I'm going to do more than Chazal like. Then, I mean, if you're actually going to follow the words of Chazal, that's playing safe as it is. Chazal tell you to be lenient. Okay. Right? You follow Divrei HaMekel Be'avel. You're supposed to be lenient in Avelut. You're supposed to be lenient in Erevin. Right? So I'm saying, oh, I've got this special Chumrah on it. Good for you. I mean, assuming that it's when you acknowledge it's a Chumrah. And it's not, well, I actually think this is the halacha, even though it's stricter than everyone else. That's a little bit different. That's an actual dispute on what you think the law is. But he says, like, oh, I'm machmir on Erevin. It's like, then you're an idiot. Because, I mean, when you put it in that way, right? If you put it in that way of like, yes, I know this is the halacha and I'm going to be strict on Erevin, you are an idiot. It's different than saying, I think that this is the halacha. Oh, other people are more lenient than I am? Yes, but I think they're wrong. Very different statement there. Right? Yeah.
So, it appears that colleagues, either in the Sanhedrin or people who are empowered to apply the law for others, can challenge each other.
Mm-hmm.
So for us lay people, when we ask for a psak,
yeah,
and we get the psak, and we ask, are we allowed to ask the rabbi to back it up? And I guess as a follow up to that, if he can't, do we still accept his psak as authoritative?
I would say this, or at least this is how I've always approached it, and this, you know, I've gotten almost entirely from my father. You'll know, I mean, you've been here long enough. I encourage people to ask, for sources. I keep telling people, you know, find me afterwards, I'll get you the source, and, like, don't trust me on it. In my opinion, every rabbi, every single one, without exception, has to be able to answer the question, what's the basis for this opinion? I mean, there are respectful ways of asking it, and there are disrespectful ways of asking it. You're always allowed to ask respectfully, where are you getting this from? Right? And then I'll tell you and try to get it back as much as possible. According to the sheet of the Rambam, it eventually has to get back to the Gemara in order for it to be considered universally authoritative. Right? To say, like, this, if someone wants to say this is usur, you have to explain why it's asur de oraita or asur de rabbanan, why it's biblical or rabbinically forbidden. If it's a chiyuv, I say, here's what you have to do, right? Then it says you have to do it because of X, Y, you know, because it's a chiyuv de oraita or chiyuv de rabbanan. If it's a matter of mitziyut, if it's a matter of like a certain reality, you can say, well, I'm getting this from, say, let's say Rav Moshe on Chalav Yisrael. So he's like, yes, I'm relying on Rav Moshe's opinions on Chalav Yisrael because here's what it says, and may even say, here's why I think it makes sense. Or here's the halachic basis I think for Rav Moshe, and here's why it convinces me. Absolutely, without question, every rabbi has to be able to answer that question, and no rabbi has any right to feel threatened by it, simply because rabbis don't have, I mean, you can, a rabbi might say, ask me privately, right? May want, not want to answer it publicly. right? Because, you know, that could sometimes get complicated. Rabbis, like I've done it here too, have said, you know, you ask me that privately, not just because, you know, because it's too complicated to be spoken about in public. Or it might confuse certain people in the audience who might not have much of a background. Meaning, if it's a complicated halachic issue, then it's an issue that has to be discussed with each person individually. Not that I'm running away from it as much as, in order for me to teach the halacha responsibly, I would need to tailor how I say it and how I approach it to each person. Right, but I would have no problem sitting with each person and doing the same thing and explaining why that psak or whatever thing that I said, keeping the same psak and keeping the same halacha, but apply things differently to other people. People have asked also very in-depth questions, like when we wait for, you know, the Baal Kore for on Shabbos. People have asked really in-depth questions that I can't answer responsibly in 5 minutes. So I'll say, ask me privately. We can have a real discussion about it. Right, so pushing things off, I don't think, is necessarily being evasive. But the main job of any rabbi is that he has to teach Torah. And that doesn't mean that doesn't have a source, but no rabbi has a right to blow someone off for asking a legitimate, serious question. Right, and say, here's where I'm getting it from, here's the basis. And that way, you know, and one of the reasons why I'm so big about giving out source sheets is because if you don't like what I say, well, fine, take it to someone else, see how they handle the sources. At least, you know, I'm not making this stuff up. And, you know, we have no problem challenging my, you know, translations and stuff, because 90% of the time it's not mine anyway, right? So fine, have a different read. But it's not the individual rabbi's Torah, and that's where it really gets with Rambam and the authority. Any authority that a rabbi has today is subsumed under whatever limited authority we have that's given to us by the Gemara. There is no rabbi today, and no rabbi since the time, certainly no single rabbi who has had any authority to say, I'm now making proclamations that are binding on the entire Jewish people. No one. Followers of a particular rabbi may say that this rabbi had this authority, but no rabbi themselves dare would have the chutzpah to say that outright, even if they thought so. So, you know, and you've got a lot of people out there making a lot of edicts, and they're going to say, I'm making my own gzera, right? That such and such a thing is forbidden. It's like, okay, you're entitled to make that gzera. And that would be sort of like finding, so the Rambam, that it's, you know, either subsumed under some other halacha, but this is what you think, you know, the halacha is. Great. Do I have any obligation to follow you? Doesn't seem to be, or at least not according to Rambam, in terms of intrinsically because it's your opinion. Whereas, you know, people have asked me a question, I'd say, well, here's the halacha, and I quote a Gemara. That's not me who's coming up with it, it's the Gemara. Like, I didn't make that stuff up. It's one of the weird things about getting smicha, where, you know, before I got smicha, people would still ask me questions, and I quote them a Shulchan Aruch. Like, fine, they wouldn't really listen to me. And, like, after I got smicha, I quote the same Shulchan Aruch, and all of a sudden I was reliable. Like, the Shulchan Aruch did not change from before or after I got smicha. But all of a sudden now, you know, I passed a test completely unrelated to what question I get asked. Oh, now all of a sudden the Shulchan Aruch is reliable. I kind of understand that. But you have to, it's important to realize that the better rabbis will sit and explain it. Not everyone will have the time, mind you, right? And some will actually, like, pawn stuff off to students to explain the details. And some will write articles, and, like, they'll say, go read this article because I lay everything out there, right? But that's the way that rabbis ought to work, right? And one of the better things that have come out these days with the rabbinic scholarship is footnotes, you know? And things are very well documented for the most part. And some people write better than others, but, you know, if you read, let's say, Rabbi, you know, Michael Broyd has been writing a lot, you know, for a long time. His stuff is very well documented. Now, you could disagree with a lot of things that he said. You can disagree with methodology. You can disagree with how he weighs sources. You can disagree with a whole lot of stuff, but you know where he's coming from because he gives you a whole lot of material, right? And even if you don't like what he says, you cannot doubt that, you know, he does his homework because he does. Right, you know, even, you know, some of the conservative movements, Truvot, some of them are very well footnoted, very well documented. Right, you can disagree wholeheartedly on a whole lot of pieces, but it's not, you know, pulling out of the ether. And once you have the things like footnotes, you know where they're coming from, which is also why I tell people who are just getting involved to, like, in Judaism and trying to learn about halacha, to pick up your, like, halacha du jour book and look before you even get to the body. Look at the footnotes and see how many people are being quoted, and then you can ask, well, how come you're quoting him here and him here and him there? Like, you're quoting a lot of different people in a lot of different cases. What does one say about each of the other issues? And then you'll wind up with a very different set of halacha. Yeah.
And what of those who go into, well, who's your guy? My guy says different. My guy's bigger. My guy can beat up your guy.
So Rambam says you follow Misha Hadat Noteh. You follow whomever convinces you, right? It doesn't matter. People who are very intelligent and very knowledgeable can say profoundly stupid things. People can say be knowledgeable about one area and be ill-informed of another. And so in one area, they're very reliable. And in another area, they say very stupid or irresponsible statements. That happens, unfortunately, well, more frequently than anyone's going to admit. So it's not a matter of personal status because there's no real way to gauge. But the whole thing with da'at noteh is it requires intellectual honesty. Of like, what's the system? Do you understand the system? Do you see how it's consistent? Do you see how it plays, how it works out? All right?
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, Rabbeinu Gershom only said, if you want to follow what I say, then don't do X, Y, and Z.
Mm.
Is that right?
I don't remember. I honestly have not read anything of Rabbeinu Gershom inside.
I mean, you could, but I thought his takanot were universal.
Well, they were universal. They were. You see, that's a weird thing with universality. People would say that it was universal among Ashkenazim, which means it's not really universal. I got that a lot in high school. Like, it was like, oh, but it's Minhag Yisrael. I was like, but not everyone does it. Well, it's Minhag Yisrael amongst Ashkenazim. It's like, that doesn't count. Or you try to find something today. Like, what's Minhag Yisrael? Well, find me something that every single Jew does. Right? And it's like, oh, well, we're not going to count conservative and reform. It's like, well, okay, so what about this? Like, we're not going to count them. Oh, so it's Minhag Yisrael amongst all the people whom you count as amongst your group, which is defined by the people who do this. And it becomes circular. Like, I heard Rav Temler say once, no respectable posek would say something. I don't want to mention the subject or the name. And I said, wait a second. So-and-so says something. I said, I repeat. No gadol who's worth anything would make this statement. But this person makes that statement. It proves he's not a gadol. There's a separate class we're going to do on gadolatry.
Are there two?
Not my word, by the way. It's from Professor Arthur Hertzberg. I actually did a post on it, so you can read up on that first. But it'll be essentially that, yeah.
So, I mean, if somebody practices polygamy or something like that, and he would say, just don't follow Rabbeinu Gershom.
Be an interesting question. Unless it would
also
be
the takana expired.
Unless it would
well,
be
aside from that.
Unless it would be minhag ha-makom, right, not to do it, but in theory... It's hard to say if you violated a biblical or rabbinic prohibition at that point. I don't know, unless it would be like the minhag of a particular place that's established, but yeah, pretty much. All right? Have a wonderful week.